But in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
We're almost at the end of the year. Everybody's rushing around doing those last-minute errands, slogging through the mall, seeing those beleaguered retail workers being dragged through retail hell as we get ready for Christmas and the holidays. You might be thinking of friends coming over, or going to church, or maybe thinking of taking a few days off if you're lucky enough. And yet with all the rushing around, with errands and so much to do, there's one thing we're told. We're told to take time with those who count with most of us, like Jeff Carlin, my buddy and producer and the guy who thought up the Chicago Way. And also coming with us today is Pat Brady, who's got a special Christmas gift for the Khan of Madaganistan, boss Michael J. Madigan. Consultant, former chairman of the Illinois Republican Party, and he's got an interest, you know, he's the guy who came up with Madiganville, you know, the whole Jimmy Buffett thing. I took it to Madaganistan. Then I read in City Journal, some dweeb from New York that people follow said, listen to this. He said he wrote a whole thing about Madaganistan in Real Clear Politics. And he said, some people call it Madaganistan. Who's that some? When you're taking my stuff, what's next? City Journal's going to write about dibs? What's going on here, Pat Brady?
I know.
Former prosecutor.
You take it as a compliment that they would want to copy you because, I said Madiganville and you came up with Madaganistan, which I thought was much better description.
Because he's crueler. But, I mean, if you're going to take a guy's stuff, at least some people, what kind of – anyway. All right, so the deal is
– well, at least we're not deplorable.
Yeah, we're not. Yeah, I am. You're not. in the meantime, what is going on with the Speaker of the House? He's now on his, third century of iron-fisted rule. In Illinois, Jeff Carlin, what's going on, Pat Brady?
Well, he has to be elected every 2 years, and it's the full House that votes for him. And apparently, he might have a challenger that's a Democrat, Scott Drury, a state rep from the northern suburbs, state representative from the northern suburbs, who's a former federal prosecutor and ran on the platform that he was going to clean up corruption. And he said that he's thinking about running, but all he needs to do is get his vote, plus 8 other Democrats, and then the 51 Republicans, which would vote for him, and Speaker Madigan's gone. He needs 60 votes, and it could happen. It could happen. A lot of these
a Christmas downstate, miracle.
It would be a Christmas miracle, but you know what? It's not as far-fetched as you might think.
Who's playing Pat Brady in the Frank Capra movie about this? Is it Jimmy Stewart or Walter Brennan? So what goes
Danny
on?
DeVito. Danny DeVito.
Yeah, right. So then what? So this Mr. Drury... Is he out publicly saying, hey, I'm going to run because I want to be speaker because Madigan kind of reminds me of Sheldon Silver in New York? Yes or no?
I think that's it. I think a lot of the rank and file are fed up speaker and the iron-fisted rule and his way or the highway. I think that's what he's thinking. Now, some young enterprising reporter probably needs to call him and talk to him.
Yeah.
But it's not unrealistic that he could get 8 Democrats. When you think about this, with Team Rauner, they have targeted Democrats, and it's always been the Democrats. You know how it goes. They'll say, I'm not sure if I'm going to vote for Madigan during the campaign, and they always do.
Like Yinling and Mussman, right?
All those people. But now they can't say that. What they say after the election is, well, Madigan was the only one that ran. I didn't have a choice. Well, now they have a choice. So if they don't vote for Drury, they're going to get pounded on by the Republicans for saying, yeah, you're in the tank with Madigan, who's got about an 18% approval rating right now.
Fascinating, Mr. Brady. And to what degree are your nimble fingers behind this coup?
I'm just a loyal servant of the state of Illinois, a taxpayer and a voter. I'm not involved, but I fully support this effort by who's ever putting it together. And maybe just Scott Drury, maybe just has good motivation. And we certainly need a change.
We definitely need a change. Illinois does need a change. There's also, I think somebody should start talking to Mr. Rauner about clearly expressing his views to the people of Illinois, which I think he's got a communications issue. Maybe he should hire you. What do you think?
Well, I think this time of year, it's kind of hard to get people to tune in to what's going on in Springfield. But I think he's been pretty clear. We're down to two things now. He just wants term limits and property tax freeze in order to get a budget. But the speaker won't budge. So he was on this weekend. I thought he was pretty good. But it's hard to – people are, I think, a little bit burned out on election rhetoric given what happened in the presidential.
But one thing is clear. If this happens, and it should happen at the beginning of next year, right? If it does happen. Someone in the Rauner camp will actually have videotape rolling about what's going on in the chamber. Usually when they vote, they do it yay or nay. It's a voice vote by acclamation. Yep. So we don't see a roll call. But if there's someone running, then there's a roll call, correct?
Exactly. And that is right there. And that's the dilemma. If you're in a even swing district and you say, hey, I voted for Madigan, man, you're going to get bombarded.
What do you think of this, Jeff Carlin?
I think change is upon us. Well, I hope change is upon us. The point about the Rauner thing, I think, is great, John, because I posted a story from like 2 years ago on Facebook. This is obviously just one example, but it was how some institutional group had went through and ranked all the states, and they found that Illinois was the worst-run state.
That's not Rauner's fault.
No. But that's not the point of the story. The point is that the story was from 2014. So I posted it being, oh, we're number one still, you know, we're a terrible state. And lots and lots and lots of people who would lean much more left were like, oh, this is all Rauner's fault. This is all Rauner's fault, without clicking on the link and realizing that the story was from before he even took office. And so the beauty of it is that people, they still blame him. They think he's the person who got us in all this trouble. But they don't have no connection to the fact that the state has been running up to this cliff for decades and who's been at the helm the whole way.
Are these the same people, Bette Brady, who believe that Vladimir Putin is the reason Hillary Clinton couldn't win?
Oh, my God, that was today, too. Yeah, you know what? I agree with Senators McCain and Schumer. This is should be nonpartisan. We need to investigate it. But the Clinton campaign, they should just fade into the woodwork because they're making themselves really look really bad.
Well, they won't, even though now Bill's out talking about stupid white guys or everyone's having their theory, and John Podesta was on over the weekend refusing to say whether it was a fair and free election. I just find this to be amazing. But to focus back on what's really important, because all politics is local, if Mr. Drury does carry through with it, what kind of pain should he expect from Madigan?
Well, Madigan will be gone. Not gone, he'll still be in the state house, but he won't be speaker. And the minute he's not speaker, his money dries up.
Yeah.
And without the money, he doesn't have the power. I mean, I would think if Madigan, if this somehow... the miracle occurred, Madigan's done. He's going to just be another rank-and-file member, and
he'd resign.
He won't have any money. Yeah, I would think he would completely resign, and maybe we'd actually get somebody in that district that represents the district and not just his interests.
Full disclosure, I did have pizza with Madigan a few days ago. Actually, I didn't have pizza with him, but he was in the same room, and he stopped at a table. I was at Palermo's on 95th and with a couple guys who were Madigan, so they like Mike Madigan. One guy does, political guy, very famous in town. And the other guy's a great doctor, Mike Byrne, podiatrist to the stars. And we're sitting there having pizza at Palermo's, and who walks by? Mike Madigan. It was just interesting. I just wanted to declare it. It was almost like it was by coincidence, Pat.
Did you guys chat it up to talk about?
No, he didn't want to talk too much to me. He did say, hello, like that, and nod, and then walk away. But he was okay. You know, we used to be a lot closer in the day back when, you know, years ago. But I kind of got tired of a state run by gangsters with everybody leaving town. All the taxpayers are leaving, and what do we get? What did Pete Phillip, that crazy man, call it? Tax eaters and tax producers, right? But it was bad. But in a way, you're seeing people with means leaving, and people who need stuff are coming, and there's no buddy talking about suburban tax issues, and that's why I think this thing is huge, what you're talking
about. Yeah, I could see a scenario where, okay, we'll vote for you as a Republican, but we want a budget deal. And I think that somebody like Drury or somebody besides Madigan, I think a deal is there to be made. It's just the guy that controls things won't do it because he doesn't want to give Rauner any victory.
No, he does not. And this will put him, if it continues, will put him in. Mike does not like being on the hot seat. He does not like even being quoted. You know, he's got a spokesman who controls the news flow, and most of the reporters go along with his dictatorial, tidbits, like when the mayor is a boss and he drops out little things, little news bits, so you could run back to your editor and show that, hey, I'm a good reporter, but really it's just dropped like crumbs. No?
Well, that was the whole theory back in the day when I was party chairman, that they don't like that exposure at all.
No.
It drives them crazy, and that was the theory.
So what do you know about Mr. Drury? Do you know much about
him? I don't know much about him other than that I know he was an assistant U.S. attorney, and he's been there, I think, two or three terms. I really don't know that much about him.
I guess we all will now, thanks to your good offices here, right?
Well, I think I'm we hoping. Will. I mean,
I got to call him up.
You got to call him up, and I think this could be done, and he would be doing a great service for the state, and I hope. But the challenge for him is he touts or presents himself as an independent thinker, crime buster, fraud buster. If he truly is, he'd step up to the plate.
If he's not, then you just put the big X right on his forehead anyway.
Yeah. You're not. Right? You're just part of the problem.
You're good, man.
That's it.
See, you know what? That's the kind of politics where it's given with a smile and friendship.
Sure.
That's even more devastating than the stuff I do, which is, you know, take a war hammer and try to bash a door down. You're doing it the other way. Like, and he really cares about politics and cares about reform, does he not? And then there we go, right? Isn't it delicious, Jack? I mean, Jeff?
Yeah. That's passive great. Aggressive, they call that, or whatever it is?
After the show, I'm going to head over to Gene and Giorgetti's, where I've been auctioned off by Misericordia for lunch. And I'm sure I'm going to ask the guys at the bar, what do they think?
You know, I was just there Friday night. I love Gene and Giorgetti.
Ding, that's our proverbial.
That's our proverbial.
Bell. Mm-hmm. Pat, so any good plans for Christmas for you? You know, you're out west, but... Well, you coming out?
Me?
You coming back? Yeah.
Well, I'll be downtown all week, but Christmas morning at 5 a.m. It'll be the Brady family tradition of getting on an airplane and going somewhere warm.
Nice.
Excellent.
There's nothing better than traveling on Christmas Day.
Sure.
Early.
You know, Kristen's doing it too. She's traveling on Christmas Day as well. It's not crowded, is it?
Not crowded. Everybody's in a good mood. You feel okay having a beer at 8 in the morning. It's a great country.
Your golf clubs are in the back in cargo, taken care of.
You know what we're going to do is that, and we've done this the last 4 or 5 years. We go out to San Diego and go surfing, which is fun. And 2 or 3 years ago, first time I took the kids, I got them lessons out there, and it was like the opening scene in Saving Private Ryan. The surf was so bad. I'm walking them onto the surf, and it's like, oh, he's down. So I like float around that ocean.
I can't
what
see
about you guys. What are you doing?
I think I'm going to get up, make myself a Christmas like mulled wine or whatever Jeff has on the menu. He's going to give me a menu, mulled wine or whatever, and then I'm going to open gifts and maybe go to church.
You ever
have
a Tom and Jerry's?
What is a Tom and Jerry's?
Tom and Jerry's is like it's about 4,000 calories a drink.
Oh, that
it's a battered drink, and you put warm rum in it. My dad used to get it when we were kids, but you can get it at some of the liquor stores in the city. It's really good.
Just take some dark Myers rum, pour it in the glass, a mug, add boiling water, brown sugar, a pat of butter, cinnamon, and a little bit of lemon zest.
Oh, my God.
Yeah? And then more dark rum. Yeah.
Oh, I like that dark
that's
rum.
Like, that's a
you
good
know what's good? When we go to Cuba, because Obama's going to let us at Havana Club.
That'll be our first spot for the podcast.
We got to do that as Sean from Elmwood Park sits on a top on a pile of Nicaraguan cigars that have gone worthless, right? As soon as Cuba's open for cigars. Poor guy.
I'll go down there. Let's do a show down there.
Yeah. All right, then. Pat Brady, I thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you, man. And
Merry Christmas, guys. We'll see you.
All right,
thanks.
See you, buddy.
Thanks,
Pat.
Bye.
Matt.
Bye.
Open the door.
told that Donald Trump doesn't read much, but if I were giving him a Christmas gift, I wouldn't be giving him the Game of Thrones Collector's Edition. I'd be giving him a book. It's called Shall We Wake the President? 2 Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office by Tevi Troy. Full disclosure here, Tevi Troy, who's brilliant, former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, a writer, and now CEO of the American Health Policy Institute, is also my friend. But he's written this book, and it's just amazing. Trump should read it. Why? Disasters happen. Presidents can make things better or worse. The Katrina hurricane, the Great Depression, acts of God, acts of man. And before we welcome Tevi, I want you to hear a little poem that was recited by children years and years ago. I had a little bird. Its name was Enza. I opened the window, and influenza. And when it was done, 50 million people worldwide had died, 1/4 of the American population had been infected, and 675,000 Americans had been killed. So let's talk to our guest, Tevi Troy. Full disclosure, Tevi's a friend, but he's also brilliant, and I love his book. Hello, Tevi.
Thanks for having me, and I don't know if the president-elect has read the book, but I know you have, and I appreciate it.
Well, one thing that is clear from reading the book is that if you don't anticipate disasters and know how to plan for them in terms of organizational handling of complicated things, you are going to, you know, have, I don't know what to say, on your shoes if you're president. You've seen it from Woodrow Wilson's, I guess you'd say, exacerbation of the influenza epidemic to President Carter's refusal to go to New York during the blackout to George W. Bush flying over Hurricane Katrina, being caught in that disastrous photograph as if he was above it all. These are things that I guess if they read the book, they'll at least be able to see the disasters that others had dealt with and how not to make those same mistakes, no?
Absolutely. You can't know what disasters you might face on your watch, but you can think about how you would deal with them, and you can build a team that is prepared to react to them. In all the cases that you mentioned, the president seemed unprepared and kind of knocked off their game by the disasters that struck them, and the American people can sense it. So in my book, It Shall Awake the President, I talk about communication strategies to reassure the American people, learning about the different mechanisms of government so that you're ready, and making sure that your staff is trained and drilled in how to deal with these things. Because as I said, you don't know what the disaster is going to be, but you're not going to go through a 4-year or an 8-year administration without facing some kind of disaster.
One thing that I forget whether it was in an interview I did before, then a pre-interview weeks ago when we met when the book came out, or recently, what amazed me was there was one segment where you're talking about different groups of bureaucrats getting together and having to give each other business cards in the same government.
Yeah.
Tell me what that means and why does that spell disaster?
So what I say is that if you have a disaster and the federal officials who are tasked to deal with it show up on site and start handing business cards to each other, then you know you've already failed. And it's going to be a failed response because that means they have not prepared for this disaster. They don't know the other people who are dealing with it. They don't know the other officials. They don't know their capabilities or their lines of responsibility. So if you're out there handing business cards at the site of disaster, it's going to be a bigger disaster.
Did that happen? I think it was Katrina, no?
Or am I mistaken? There have been instances where that happened, and I've definitely seen instances where federal officials who've been in agencies for decades show up and are handing out business cards to each other like they've never met. And sometimes this even happens within the same agency. So, you need to get together. You need to have some of these drills. And I participated in some of these tabletop exercises, and they really make a difference in how you think about disasters because there's all kinds of spillover effects that you don't anticipate unless you've actually been through a live fire exercise.
Donald Trump's war on the establishment bureaucracy continues. He's putting people in who will say or he said he wants to dismantle or cut the strength of certain agencies. How does that mind, that cut of mind, impact on planning for disaster, as you relate in your book, Shall We Wake the President?
That is a really good question, because I've already seen some worrisome signs about media articles where federal officials are complaining about the Trump administration or saying they don't want to work with the Trump administration. I mean, we have a constitutional system with a peaceful transfer of power, and if you have that kind of behavior, it could make things worse in cases of a disaster. So I would hope that people recognize the responsibility of their positions and that the civil service is there to respond to the policy direction set by the president. Now, of course, it does go both ways. There should be respect for the good work that the civil service does. But if there's not cooperation, you could have worse situations if a disaster strikes.
We've had situations in Chicago where certain bureaucracies drag their feet to make mayors or aldermen look bad, right? I can't imagine, though, with a disaster that bureaucracies would do that. But perhaps their paranoia or fear of, you know, a Trump upsetting the apple cart and threatening the bureaucratic establishment just by getting elected might throw a wrench into all that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's worse in cities where it just seems more personal. There's more direct involvement. When you have a sprawling 2+ million person bureaucracy, I think it's less personal disagreement. So you have things like when Bill de Blasio said those things about the police, and all the police turned their back on him, and there were questions about a work slowdown. Maybe they wouldn't be as aggressive going after crime. So you do see that in cities. I don't know, and I don't think we've seen it in the federal government up to now, and I would hope we don't see it now, but you are seeing some anonymous, to be sure, but quotes from federal career officials that I have found troubling up to this point.
If we could go back in history, my father was born in 1918. It's amazing I'm here today because by most lights, he should have been taken in the influenza epidemic of 1918, right? Or is it 1919?
It was 1918, and it's a great thing that he wasn't taken, because we're glad to have you.
Thank you, Tebby.
That was it.
Because we had a great breakfast the other time when you came back. Yeah.
But even got a column out of it.
But in that epidemic, you had a disease, right? Influenza. How did President Wilson exacerbate and make it worse for the United States?
Well, there are two ways. First of all, this disease killed 675,000 Americans. It lowered the life expectancy in the United States by a decade, which is really a staggering number. There are people dying, and President Wilson was sending U.S. troops to Europe to fight in World War I on troop transports, and he was told by his Navy doctor that those troop transports were spreading the disease and that he should stop sending them on these troop transports. The chief of staff of the military objected, and Wilson sided with the chief of staff of the military, and the troop transports continued, even though it was only 1 month before the hostilities in Europe ended. The second way is the propaganda machine that Wilson set up that was trying to highlight the war effort and give short shrift to any other problems that were going on in the country, really undercut the ability to get out the word and the message about how bad the disease was and some strategies for combating it. So I think there were two ways in which he exacerbated it, and it was a real tragedy.
But physically, he would not stop the troop transports coming back from Europe or going to Europe?
Going to Europe, and those were spreading the diseases among U.S. servicemen, but also among the people of Europe. And it was a really terrible disease. Millions of people died worldwide.
And why did he keep doing it? Why was he doing it that way? What else could he have done? And he refused.
But we could have said, we're going to stop sending these until we figure out how the disease is being spread, or maybe make them less crowded so people are weren't on top of each other, or just say, we have a certain number of troops there that we're coming close to the end of hostilities. Let's stop the transfers right now. So, there were things he could have done, but he just decided to do none of the above and didn't even make the effort. So it was disappointing, if you ask me.
What other disasters are we talking about? Would you call that an act of God or an act of man? Because you refer to both. I guess you'd call it an act of God.
I call that kind of disease an act of God, but I have acts of men in the book as well. I talk about some kind of bioterror attack, and we haven't had a full-fledged bioterror attack in the U.S., but we have had things that could seem similar, like the poisonings in Chicago of Tylenol in the 1980s that killed seven people and panicked the nation, or the anthrax mailings in 2001 that shut down the Postal Service and the U.S. Senate for a while. So I do worry about taking these horrible diseases that that we know can kill millions of people in the natural world, and then use of man-made technology to spread them, and that is a worry that I have, and I have a chapter about that in the book as well.
What is the what have you been hearing from policymakers and your colleagues in Washington? You spent many years in Washington; you're still connected there. I'm sure that there are many who thank you, right, for putting this out just so that the American people can, in some small measure, pressure their Congress to pay attention to this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I've written about the need for the Trump transition team to set up a Black Swan organization, which is a separate team within the transition to look at disasters and how a president would handle them if they happened in the first few months before the federal government is fully staffed with political appointees. You know, I found this phenomenon of the first-year disaster that has struck a number of presidents, including the swine flu that hit President Obama in his first 3 months, the 9/11 obviously happened in Bush's first year, and even the famous stock market crash in 1929, that was in Herbert Hoover's first year, and obviously his administration never recovered, and the country took a long time to recover.
So tell me about Black Swan. What does that mean?
So Black Swan is, there's a book by Nassim Taleb that talked about events that people don't expect or anticipate, and so they don't either price it into the market or take it into account in their planning. And so a Black Swan is an event that comes out of nowhere and seemed to be unexpected. And so the Romney transition, with which I was affiliated in 2012, obviously didn't come to full fruition.
Right.
But I was affiliated with that transition, and there was a Black Swan team, a group that just sat around and said, what happens if the Romney administration comes to power and there's a massive cyber attack or a massive disease outbreak? How do we deal with that in the first few months before the government's fully set up?
Are you concerned? On one side, you have Donald Trump as a bombastic, fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants fellow. On the other hand, you have this cold, calculating mentality that created a fortune, and you don't become a billionaire by accident. So which one are we going to see as disasters, and they always come, hit Donald Trump in the United States?
So I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal where I talked about some of the positive attributes that a president or Trump would bring to disasters, and one of them was his ability to communicate and his sense of the moment. So in August, we had these floods in Louisiana in the Baton Rouge area, and President Obama didn't go down initially to the region, and Secretary Clinton certainly didn't go to the region at all, and Trump seized the moment, and he went down there and he was handing out supplies to the people who had been affected by the flood. I thought that was a good sense of timing and communicating compassion, so I thought that was a positive sign. On the other hand, as you're suggesting, sometimes he says things that are, I guess intemperate.
We need to keep his thumbs.
Information.
We need the presidential thumbs to be put in those Chinese, those toys that we had
at
the dime store, whatever those were, the Chinese thumb toy.
At the Chinese handcuffs.
Yeah, handcuffs.
But you do, on the one hand, you do need to be careful what you say in terms of disaster. I tell a story in the book about Ari Fleischer, who was President Bush's press secretary in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, holds up a sign to Bush when he's talking to the media saying, don't say anything yet, because you don't want to blame it on some group that wasn't responsible for it, and you don't want to mis-explain what's going on. So I think that's really important. On the other hand, you say put President Trump's thumbs in handcuffs, but that Twitter account that he has is a very valuable tool for getting necessary information out to American people in times of crisis. And we should think about how you can convey the message to people where they are so they know whether to shelter in place or evacuate or handle whatever crisis comes their way. So I think modern technology tools obviously can be misused, but they can also be very valuable.
In the time of Trump, if there's one book that you should read, it is this one, Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office by my friend Tevi Troy, former Deputy Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Tevi, thank you very much.
Thanks thank you very much, and happy holidays to you and your family.
And you too, man. And we'll see each other soon. Bye. We're going to be taking next week off for Christmas. But every year I do something, write it and rewrite it, and run it on Christmas Eve, and we'll do it again. It starts this way. For all the children who should be loved always, but especially on this miraculous night, with our arms around them and a long goodnight kiss on the temple, a kiss more precious than anything wrapped in a box. For all the parents lingering in the doorways of the bedrooms, watching the sleeping shapes. For every child who is not loved and grows up with a hard crust around his heart because someone neglected to plant those kisses and give those hugs. For those who adopt a child to save a life. For every woman who has given up her baby for adoption to save that life inside her. For those who've tried to have children and are unable. For those who've lost their children. And children who've lost their moms and dads. And for all the crazy uncles who'll drink too much tonight and sneak outside and put on that red suit and rush back in to surprise the kids. And for the wise aunts who make strong coffee so the crazy uncles might sober up. For all the members of all the choirs of the world, for weeks they've been practicing in cold, empty churches, tonight is the night they will carry us with their beautiful harmonies, and their voices invite us to humble ourselves so that we may ask for help in scraping away any bitterness that has taken root over the year. For all the friends and relatives who don't wait for a special night to build a family, they're the ones who show up with a coffee cake on some random Saturday morning in May or a cool evening in November, dropping by just to see if you're okay. And so tonight is for them, and tomorrow too, at that table of joy, because they're family by friendship, by blood, by acts of family. And for everyone who keeps their sense of humor, for those who are patient, for those who are kind, the shy ones who don't mix in with the ruling clique at work, yet who would stun you with their grace and talent if given half the chance. For everyone who is far away and can't make it home, for those who've made bad choices and know it, and hope to repair what's been broken. For all those who feel tired and lost and worry that the hour is too late for them to return. Remember, tonight is the night of new hope, and the door is always open. Just reach for it and see. And for those old guys at the end of the bar, nursing their drinks, half watching the TV, men who are grateful for noise and warmth around them, and for the old women alone, awake in their beds, remembering nights past, and the laughter of children, on those nights when there was so much to do, and a house full of hungry guests to feed. For those parents who are overwhelmed and out of work or underemployed, for those good people who refuse to show fear, and for their children who pretend not to see. For all those working tonight, who must work tomorrow, the police officers, firefighters, and paramedics, and their families who wait for them at home. For everyone in a hospital tonight, especially those praying for dignity and relief and an end without shame or suffering. For the physicians who take time to give comfort, for the nurses who enter the room, pull up a chair, and listen to quiet confessions. For the clergy who have struggled with belief, yet find it again and are renewed. For the sailors at sea staring out into cold black water, remembering brightly lit rooms. For the members of the U.S. Armed Forces who protect us with their bodies and their lives. For members of the U.S. Foreign Service and the Intelligence Services. For their loved ones who wait and can't say why. For the farmers who feed us. For our teachers who, together with parents, instill the love of learning. For librarians who nurture the love of good books. And for every one of you who keep the faith and refuse to be shamed away from it. and for those who hold true and prize liberty over security. For all the young taken by violence in our brutalized cities, and for our great nation and the American people who never, ever quit. And to those of you whom I've hurt with pointed and thoughtless words on my very bad days, I'm sorry. And for those who give this column a chance, 4 days a week, and send those letters and emails that I share with my wife, Betty, we can't thank you enough. And for everyone who keeps hold of what is truly important about this night, it is a message brought to us by that perfect child born in a manger in Bethlehem so very long ago. He came to light the world, and he is the gift, and it is all about love. And I hope it comes to you and comforts you and remains. So from all of us to all of you and yours, Merry Christmas.